welcome back to Shadowy Mist. There is, by the way, there's another story about anointing. It's where we find the mixture that goes into the concoction, if you will, that is used for this setting apart and preparing someone to serve. That is blends of herbs and olive oil, plant material and olive oil. And it's really among the Lowy, the priests who are appointed by the Torah to officiate at the Moed Mikre, to demonstrate how these tangible symbols all convey the prophetic message of how Yahweh is going to intervene on our behalf on Pesach, Matzah, Bukurim, Shavua, Teruah, Kippurim, and Sukkah, to provide the way from our religious and political, militarized, economically jaundiced world to his home. So they too are set apart to serve. Now, there is no way that anyone would know today whether or not they were a Lowy. And the temple does not exist, nor the tabernacle for them to perform these procedures. So you have within the Torah and the prophets and Psalms so many things that you just can't do. That's why I'm just so amazed on how many people are fixated on obeying the Torah as opposed to observing it so that you understand it. There, you can learn a lot from the mixture of ingredients and the idea of being prepared and set apart to serve, particularly as a messenger, and you can apply those to your life and to your the whole process of immersing yourself in Yahweh's testimony and then sharing it. There's lots of things, particularly the role of the set apart spirit in enlightening us and then preparing us to be effective conveyors of his testimony. So there's lots we can learn from this. I think there's very little for us to do beyond being observant, thoughtful, and being open to convey what we learned, to share what we have learned. And that's my view of most everything that Yahweh has to say, is that it's there for us to come to know, to understand, and to share. Now, I want to return to where we were in Paul's testimony through his translator, through his attaché, through the historian Luke, as it's recorded in the book of Acts. Virtually everything in the book of Acts from the ninth chapter on is all about Paul and is rotten, therefore, but this is no exception from that. We're going to begin here now in Acts 9:15. We covered a bit of this territory on Friday, but we're going to move on through it. Paul claims that the Lord was speaking to Ananias, a fellow that wouldn't be known apart from Paul's testimony. There's no real indication that such a fellow ever lived. I think he's probably more of a figment of Paul's imagination than anyone. And it's odd just in its inception in that Paul claims to have spent have a revelation directly from God that did not get filtered through any man, and yet he's having his God be prepared to convey this message to Paul. Now, why would he need that if he spoke directly to Paul, if he revealed himself directly to Paul? And then, second unto that, since Paul claims that he went off and spent 3 years in Arabia getting his message directly from God, what in the purpose? What is the purpose of Ananias? Why even bother with him? And lastly, since Yahweh has told us everything we need to know him and to understand what he's offering in his Torah, prophets, and Psalms, why does anybody need a revelation from an individual? I mean, when Yahushua was asked a question, he didn't say, "Hey, go talk to Ananias." No, he said, go read the Torah, prophets, and Psalms. A lot of times he even said, why are you asking me? Why don't you just read the Torah? It answers all of your questions. And so if that was the answer that Yahusha gave time and time again, this whole pretense that Paul is establishing here is just a bunch of malarkey. But then spoke to him the Lord, who the Lord is Satan's name and title, according to the Torah, prophets, and Psalms. Go, because the chosen implement and instrument for me is the one to remove and carry away the burden of the name of me in sight of the nations, races, and the sons of kings and Israel. Now, we went through this at great detail on Friday, that Paul never once shared Yahusha's name. Never once. Never once explained the weight of his name, what Yahusha means, that it's Yahweh saving us. And once you know what his name means, then you no longer focus on his name. You focus on Yahweh, because he is Yahweh saving us. It is why I tell Christians that claim that they are followers of Jesus Christ, is that you don't even know his name. And if you don't know his name, I can assure you, you don't know him, because his name explains who he is and what he did. Who's the one actually doing what needs to be done? Just as Masiach speaks of the work of Yahweh, Yahusha is Yahweh saves. That's what it means. Paul never explains that, not once. So this proposed mission, if this was the intent, then the Lord is a nincompoop, because it never once occurred. 13 letters and chapter after chapter of Acts, all these public declarations, never once does Paul write. Or does Paul say, his name is Yahusha, and his name means Yahweh saves. Therefore, we know who he is, that he is the human manifestation of Yahweh, a diminished and set apart manifestation engaged in honoring the Torah's promises to save us. Never is that explained. Now, this is supposed to be the Lord continuing to speak, I am assuming, to Ananias, because I, by him, will provide a glimpse into the intimate secrets, as much as is necessary, as it is currently required and actually inevitable for him, for the sake of the name of me, to suffer through this experience. So, we got two issues here. One is, Yahusha doesn't have any secrets. Doesn't have any secrets. There's not a single secret associated with Yahusha. Once you understand his name, for example, you know he's just Yahweh in human form. A diminished manifestation of God set apart to honor his promises. It's no secret. Everything that he did and said was foretold in the Torah, prophets, and Psalms. His participation in Pesach and Matzah and Bukurim, foretold in the Torah, prophets, and Psalms. The most detailed eyewitness accounts, the most accurate eyewitness accounts of what he came here to accomplish on Pesach, Matzah, and Bukurim, presented in Psalm 22, Psalm 88, written 1,000 years before these events transpired in our ordinary flow of time. And again in Yeshaya 53, 54, where Yahweh is explaining why he's doing these things and what the experience would be like. There's no secret. You know, if you wanted an intimate glimpse into into that which was necessary and required of Yahusha, read the Torah, prophets, and Psalms. It's all there. Like, I have devoted an entire volume of the Torah, prophets, and Psalms, the salvation volume, to providing the eyewitness accounts of what occurred in Yahusha's life, particularly the fulfillment of Pesach, Matzah, and Bukurim, as they are presented in the Torah, prophets, and Psalms. There are no secrets. It's all known. It's why when Yosha was asked by Nicodemus, for example, you know, you read the story in Yohanan, I think it's in the third chapter, and you know, he says, I want to know how to have eternal life. And, you know, Yosha says, you know, you have to be born of water, which is our physical mortal birth, and of spirit, which is when we're adopted into the covenant family. That happens on Mukutim, following Pesach and Matzah. And Nicodemus says, hey, well, you know, how do I get born again? And Yosha says, come on. How is it that you, a teacher of the Torah, don't know this? No secret. I've told you. Read the Torah. So this whole train of thought, if you want to call it that, is completely inconsistent with Yahweh's Torah, prophets, and Psalms, where he tells us everything we needed to know. You know, when you read in the Psalms that Yahweh's Torah is complete, lacking nothing, providing everything that is necessary to restore the soul, and easy to understand for those who are open-minded. Either God's an idiot and doesn't know what the reality, or he lied, which is worse than being an idiot. Or it's true that the Torah, prophets, and Psalms contain everything you need to know. And if they provide everything that you need to know about Yahweh, including Yahweh's means to save us, which they do, then there aren't any intimate secrets, much less necessary, which are required to be known. And, of course, here there's the repeat of, for the sake of the name. Well, the name is Yahweh. Paul never, ever communicates Yahweh's name, ever once. Never in spoken form, as compiled by Luke throughout Acts. Never in written form in any of his letters. Never once writes out Yahweh's name. Never once explains the nature of the name. Never once does what we have done so many times on this program, to go through the Hebrew letters, the four letters that appear in Yahweh's name, one of which is repeated, so there's three different letters, and explain what each of those letters was drawn to represent and how it conveys Yahweh as our Father, enriching his covenant children. The second part of this next statement by Paul is also ridiculous. That it says that for the sake of the name of me, he was have to suffer through this experience. The idea of Yahweh's plan of reconciliation with us, his plan of immortality and perfection and adoption and empowerment and enrichment and of communicating the message and of reconciling his relationship so we can live with him. The whole concept of us participating and engaging in the covenant is about him suffering as a loving father to elevate and enrich and empower and benefit his children. Yahweh does not want us to suffer. His witnesses are never asked to suffer for him. Now, it's true that there are some of Yahweh's prophets who were attacked and suffered as a result of their testimony on behalf of Yahweh being in opposition to religion and politics. But Yahweh didn't say, you know, I want you to suffer for my name. He didn't go to Yahshua and said, hey, dude, I'm looking for somebody willing to suffer for my name. When he contacted Moshe around Mount Horeb in Arabia, he didn't say, hey, Moshe, you old guy, you know, you're 80 years old, you're out here herding sheep, but I've got a better gig for you. I want you to suffer for my name. No. He didn't go to Dodd and say, you know, I am so impressed with your knowledge, your intellect, and your understanding of the Torah. What I want to do is anoint you, Dodd, so you can suffer for my name. I mean, come on. This is ridiculous. Yes, I understand that Yahusha suffered for the name of Yahweh. But Yahusha is a diminished manifestation of Yahweh. That's our Father suffering on our behalf so we wouldn't have to. That's the whole concept here. This notion that Paul suffered and was called to suffer for the name is absurd. First of all, he never shared the name. He was never got any flack for having shared the name. Ever once. Never once suffered as a result of the name. Yahusha. Never once. And second, it's not what God calls us for. When Yahusha was finding his disciples and he went up to Shimon and Yahuchanan, sons of thunder, did he say, "Hey guys, I got this really great gig for you. What I want you to do is come and suffer for my name." No. I do this program. I write books on Yahweh's testimony. When I began this, and throughout the process, I was never asked to suffer for doing so. You look at the people that Yahusha encountered during his ministry. He healed them. Didn't blind them. Didn't cause them to suffer. Can you find a case where Yahusha had someone, where he encaged someone, and he said, "Hey, you over there, I want you to suffer for me." Now, he attacked people and said, you religious buffoons are hypocrites. You're scumbags. He met other people and he says, "I'll be glad to heal you." He met others and said, "I don't know why you're asking me this question. It's answered in the Torah." But never did he say, "You're going to go off and suffer for my name." No, what Paul is writing is preposterous. Now, in the prior statement, Paul claimed that Ananias told the Lord that he had heard from many about the man who had the greatest extent possible done immoral and injurious things to your set-apart ones in Jerusalem, and that here, in Damascus, Syria, he, Paul, has the authority of the chief priest to forcefully bind and imprison everyone calling on your name. Now, that's the previous statement. But the fact is, the rabbis, the chief priests, had no authority to do this in Israel. They had no authority to do this in Jerusalem. There is a 0% chance that the Romans authorized Jewish religious leaders to be able to imprison people and deal with them forcefully in Damascus, Syria. Historically, this is preposterous. Didn't happen, folks. So the point of all this is obvious, that this is just another contrived fable on Paul's behalf to make it look like he were the chosen one. Most every Middle East historian of the period acknowledges that there were no Jewish high priests outside of Jerusalem, much less Jewish high priests in Damascus, much less Jewish high priests in Damascus that had any authority. And outside of Israel, the priests had no authority anywhere. They were persona non grata by this time, by the Roman government, and were losing what little authority they had. Adding to the fable, had there really been a man named Ananias, based upon the Hebrew chokanyah, meaning mercy is from Yahweh, he would have been known to that Yahweh didn't need Paul's help. So if in fact this fellow existed, and if this fellow was in fact someone that knew Yahusha, then he would have known that there was no way that Yahweh needed any help, much less from Paul, to reveal any secrets. Now, turning to the alleged testimony of Shaul's Lord. Knowing that Yahusha chose the 12 disciples at the time Shaul was available in Jerusalem and that he was not selected, we are now to believe that Paulos, as a reward, I presume, for being especially immoral and injurious, is now going to be chosen in hindsight. This resolutely religious and evil man claimed to be the implement of God, which is similar to Maaseiah, to the implement doing the work of Yahweh. It is yet another attempt to position himself as God's co-savior and co-messenger, something that Paul does with reckless abandon. But consider what the Lord wanted Shaul, the man who changed his name to Paulos, to do with his onoma, name and reputation. Onoma is the Greek word for name and reputation. Shem is the Hebrew word. The Lord did not select Shaul to introduce his name, to explain his name, to share his name, to proclaim his name, to invite people to Yahweh using his name, or say people in his name, even say his name, all things which would have been vitally important, and none of which Paul actually did. The Lord, which is Satan's title, from the name Baal, chose Shaul to bastazo, remove and carry away the burden of his name and reputation. That is something that Satan craves and Yahusha disdains. This is because Yahusha's name is uplifting, describing the means that Yahweh deploys to carry away our burdens. But Satan's reputation as the adversary needs to be jettisoned for him to beguile souls into worshiping him as if he were God. So by selecting the bastozo, the Lord has to be Satan, who is the only one who would benefit from having the burden of his adversarial name and reputation removed and carried away. It would be senseless and counterproductive for God to ask for such a thing. And then we find Shaul's Lord mimicking Paul's mantra, which is revealing secrets. Shaul even has his Lord say that the selection and implementation of Paul was not only inevitable, it was actually compulsory and required. As for suffering, Yahusha's sacrifice on our behalf was not only part of a very specific plan, it was now long past. So once again, Paul's Lord cannot want this communicated. But Satan's ordeal would, in fact, endure. So, if we are to believe Paul's testimony here, the 3 years Yahusha spent with his disciples was a colossal waste of time. All of the prophecies and instructions Yahusha spoke to Shimon would hereby be nullified. His name would have not only been irrelevant, it was a burden. He wanted removed his name. His teaching, the Torah's teaching, must be hidden, and the secrets that were just now going to be revealed were secrets so intimate, God himself must have been too shy to share them himself. And as for the free will and of God being powerful, sorry, he desperately needed Paul and was compelled to deploy him. Because God himself, Yahusha, couldn't share any of this, couldn't accomplish any of this on his own. Now he just squandered those 3.5 years. And now that he realized that he was a complete disaster, a waste of time, he's going to go to this man. Not that we require more evidence to distrust Shaul, but this statement contradicts Paul's testimony throughout Galatians, where he divides the world, giving Shimon, Jacob, and Yaokanan responsibility for the Jews, while he assumed authority over every other nation and race. And in this statement, Paul is given the races in addition to Israel. And lastly, even if we discount the troublesome vocabulary Ishaal's mission was to carry Yahweh's name to every race and place, then he failed miserably. Not one Christian in a million. Not one Christian in a million knows God's name. But since Christians the world over know how to proclaim the Lord's name, Satan was obviously the spirit who chose Paul. Fixated as they both were on immorality and injury, on submission and death, on secrets and concealment, they were a perfect match. After all, Shaul's testimony has been dishonest, and Lord Baal is the prince of lies. As an interesting study, consider how many false gods have been called the Lord, as in Baal, which means Lord in Hebrew. He was the dominant deity of the Canaanites, of the Phoenicians, of the Babylonians, of the Assyrians. The Philistines worshipped the infamous Beelzebub. Remarkably, the center of Baal Lord worship was the town of Baal Shemon, the Lord of Destruction. In that we first considered Galatians 1:17 many days ago, let's review it again, in advance of presenting the Christian renditions. It said, I did not ascend into Jerusalem towards the goal of being with or against the apostles before me, but to the contrary, I went away, withdrawing to Arabia, and returned again to Damascus. Well, as I said before, it would have been a great story, if only it were true. These translations are passable, notwithstanding that there is no J in Hebrew, Greek, Latin, or even in English prior to the 17th century. The King Iams, now known as the King James, reads, Neither went I up to Jerusalem, Jerusalem is the way that they've written it, to them which were apostles before me, but I went into Arabia and returned again unto Damascus. It reads similarly to the Latin Vulgate. Neither did I go to Jerusalem, to those who were apostelos before me. Instead, I went to Arabium, and next I returned to Damascus. The New Living Translation published, Nor did I go up to Jerusalem to consult with those who were apostles before I was. Instead, I went away to Arabia, and later I returned to the city of Damascus. You'll notice, however, that all three texts made a reasonable attempt to transliterate the scriptural name for Jerusalem. Scriptural name for Arab, as well as the scriptural name for Damascus. So why were they all unwilling to transliterate Yahusha and Maaseiah accurately? I mean, here they understand that names should be transliterated. That means that you replicate the sound of the name in the new language. So they took the Hebrew words for Jerusalem, Arab, and Damascus, and they transliterated them. Jerusalem, Arab, and Damascus. But Yahusha, the name being proclaimed here, and Maaseiah, the basis of the title, they changed. Why would they do that? Why would they change Yahusha to Jesus and Maaseiah to Christ? They had nothing in common. They're not. Their names, they should have been transliterated. Should they have the sound replicated? They didn't do so. It's those kinds of inconsistencies which shows that the intent was to mislead. It's not an accident. Now, by way of background, Shaul, meaning question him, and indistinguishable from Sheol, the place of questioning more commonly called hell, was born and initially educated in Tarsus, the capital of the Roman province of Cilicia, which was, it's on the Mediterranean coast of what is now southern Turkey today. It lies directly south of Galatia, the Roman province Paul was addressing in his first letter. At the time, he was, or this area was home to the world's preeminent university. Shaul's father was both Jewish from the tribe of Benjamin and a Roman citizen, things which will loom large as this story unfolds. His father may also have been a Pharisee, which affirms why Shaul remained a religious fundamentalist. For a frame of reference, it's about 500 miles from Tarsus, southeast to Damascus. Similarly, Mount Horeb, also known as Mount Sinai in Arabia, is another 500 miles by foot, almost due south of Damascus. Horeb is directly east of Nuweiba Beach on the west coast of the Gulf of Aqaba and is known as Jabal al-Lauts in Saudi Arabia. You can Google it in Google Maps. Jerusalem lies between the two, less than 200 miles south-southwest of Damascus. So now that we know where these places are in reference to where Paul grew up, we'll return and consider more of what the disingenuous one has to say. So after lying and telling us that he went to Arabia, but not even bothering to humor us with a word of what was spoken there, Paul revealed exactly how long he remained in the wilderness. And that is odd because other than incriminate himself, the one detail he shared was completely and otherwise irrelevant. Then later, with 3 years' time, I ascended up to Jerusalem to visit and get acquainted with Kephesh. Kephesh is a transliteration of the Aramaic word keph, meaning stone or rock. It's a reference to Shimon, who became Petros, a transliteration of the Greek word for stone, and is today called Peter. And remained against, this is Kai Mino, stayed and persevered, endured and abided, continuing to persist against, this is Pros, him 15 days. All right, so, yeah, it's got Paul transition in Galatians 1:18 out of 1:17, where he said that he went to Arabia first. Now he says that he was there for 3 years' time, and then he ascended up to Jerusalem to visit and get acquainted with Kephesh, and he remained there against him for 15 days. Now, while it may be relevant, Papyrus 46 uses meno, which is the word for stayed in that translation, in the final clause, while later scribes wrote epimeno, a related word which is more emphatic with regard to Shaul remaining in close proximity to Shimon. However, since the Nestle Allen was compiled from the most popular text, not the oldest manuscripts, the Nestle Allen, McReynolds and Linear was oblivious to the alteration by later scribes. It reads, "Then after 3 years, I went up to Jerusalem to visit with Kephesh, and I stayed on toward him days 15. It is instructive to know that Moshe was on Mount Sinai for 40 days, during which time he received the entirety of the Torah, a 300-page book with prophecies so astounding and insights so profound, the resulting document left little doubt that it was inspired by God. And yet, if we are to believe Paul's story here in Galatians as opposed to his story in Acts, Shaul was in Arabia for 3 years. And this pathetic letter is the product of all that time. Not a single prophecy, not a single profound insight, nothing to suggest divine inspiration, versus the 40 days that Moshe received the Torah and the brilliance of that stone? Rather than being equipped to share Yahweh's Torah, teaching us as Moshe had been, and explain how Yahusha had honored the Torah's most essential promises by fulfilling the initial mikre, we get an angry and egotistical diatribe that serves to negate everything God has said and done in Paul's letter as he comes down off of this mountain. The interesting nuance in this passage is one we considered earlier. Paul may have been more comfortable communicating in Hebrew and Aramaic than he was in Greek, recognizing that Petros, meaning rock or stone in Greek, wasn't Shimon's actual name, but instead his nickname. He was at liberty to translate it, which is what he did, but into Aramaic, the official language of Tarsus, would have been Latin. Aramaic would also have been spoken as a result of the Babylonian, Assyrian, and Persian influence in the region. So we should always be mindful of the fact that if a statement is being made by God, or if two Israelites are in the midst of a discussion, then the Greek text represents a translation of what was said in Hebrew or Aramaic. The reference to the disciple Shimon as Kephish keeps us mindful of this distinction, which is true for the entirety of the eyewitness and historical accounts. It is a distinction, however, that was lost on Francis Bacon and his associates. But other than changing the name and place and person, the rest of the King James is reasonably accurate. It reads, "Then after 3 years I went to Jerusalem to see Peter, and abode with him for 15 days. The Latin Vulgate reads almost identically. The Nilt says, "Then 3 years later I went to Jerusalem to get to know Peter, and I stayed with him for 15 days. I don't think so. We'll return tomorrow. May God bless.